Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Nadassar Ahmed, Managing Partner of Unitas Communications and a proud member of the Global Ties United States Board of Directors. And this is PR Unmasked. Welcome to today's episode. We will be discussing the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom, the importance of this relationship in combating hostile state influences, and the role of public diplomacy and exchange. Hostile states have increasingly been launching multi-pronged attacks against Western nations to steal technologies, compromise academic research, spread disinformation, and threaten critical infrastructure. To strengthen the US-UK relationship and to counter these threats, the US Embassy in London, in partnership with Global Ties, have created the Countering Hostile States Influence Program, promoting the prosperity of the United States, protecting the US national security through joint diplomacy, deepening long-term economic and commercial ties with the UK, and ultimately advancing our shared values, interests, and continued coordinated action. Global Ties US, of course, is the largest and oldest citizen diplomacy network in the United States. Its mission is to empower individuals, communities, and nations to build trust and to advance peace and prosperity through international exchange. Global Ties has been a nonprofit partner of the US Department of State for over 60 years, and we support a network that includes 83 community-based member organizations serving in all 50 US states. These member organizations host international visitors through educational, cultural, and professional exchange programs. The Countering Hostile States Influence Program consists of three exchange programs that each bring UK stakeholders to the United States to explore various aspects of US federal, state, local, and civil society responses and strategies. These exchanges create the foundation for cooperation, respect, and trust across communities and between leaders in government, business, and civil society. As such, they are a powerful tool to build alliances to tackle the toughest transnational challenges. Today, we will be centering our discussion around the messaging and focus of recently completed Protecting Sensitive Industries Exchange, designed for representatives from relevant UK government ministries, private industry, and academia, where participants were invited to learn more about the US government and industry strategies for protecting sensitive technology, particularly in the military, scientific, and energy sectors. Without further ado, I would like to welcome our expert panel. Today, we are joined by Sydney Smith, who's a seasoned diplomat, a communications expert, and current cultural affairs officer at the US Embassy in London. And we also have with us Paul Everett, who is the former chief executive of the ADS Group, trustee of the Aerospace Technology Institute, and chairman of Farnborough International. I'd like to now open up and have a discussion and examine the topic of protecting sensitive industries from hostile states more broadly. So, in a recent RAND research report, it's argued that Russia is not a peer competitor to the United States, but a well-armed rogue state that seeks to undermine the international order, which it knows it cannot dominate. However, China is seen as a peer competitor because it wants to shape and ultimately control the international order for its own interests. Both countries seek to alter the status quo. So just to set off with that kind of opening statement, so in this context, Paul, how do you think this affects the way we look at sensitive industries in the UK?
I guess it's worth just taking a step back, Modesta, and just recognise that, you know, over the course of the last, 5 to 10 years, we've seen some significant shocks and disruption to what we might see as our, you know, normal diplomatic and industrial relationships. And we can run that from the invasion of Crimea, obviously the war in Syria, from a UK perspective, certainly Brexit, recently the pandemic, and now Ukraine. So much of the relationships that we had and the way in which we normally did business have seen significant shift. I think we would have to separate out the events in Russia from China. So far, China has not invaded anyone directly. And I think they are by far the major player in the world alongside the US and other major Western democracies. You know, China is setting itself up and has set itself up as a challenger, both politically, diplomatically, and industrially to what we would see as the democratic West. You look at the relationships it's developed in many parts of the world, relationships which are about its longer term, I suppose, industrial reach, but also about how it gains access to much of the, we would see, the raw materials, if you like, which will secure technological advantage into the future. So the bigger challenge is around our relationship with China. And again, over the course of the last decade or so, that has changed. One, because of the change, if you like, the leadership of China and the way it's sort of more autocratic in its outlook, but also from, if you like, the shocks that I've mentioned have also changed our relationship. You know, China was a big market for many high-end goods and services, less so now, but it was also one of the workshops of the world. And the West took advantage of low-cost product from China. And we are now seeing the weakness of that approach. And certainly the growth of populism in many democracies has at least in part stemmed from public concern around, if you like, how globalization has worked for folks at home.
Fascinating. There's so much to unpack there. But I want to bring Sydney in. I want to ask you, Sydney, what do you see as the most significant differences between the way Russia and China pose a challenge to US global influence?
I think, as Paul said, is right to point out that these are two very different states. And in light of Russia's recent invasion of Ukraine, I think what you're looking at there is something that's not just a threat to the US, but a very immediate threat to Ukraine itself and also its other neighbors, who are then looking at Russia and trying to see what this means for them, what this bodes for the future. And I think for a long time, we looked at this as simply a disruptor in a space that potentially it was unable to engage with it the same way it had done in the past. But now we're seeing a world that looks very similar maybe to what we saw in the past, and that kind of actual tactical approach rather than just an online disruptor, as we saw Russia play in disrupting electoral issues, not just in America, but also in other countries throughout Europe. And in terms of China, you know, President Biden has said the relationship will be cooperative when it can be, competitive when it needs to be, and really trying to think through, I think, a longer term strategy, because China is a massive country. Its needs and interests have to be taken into account. And I think we have to look at the fact that it needs resources like any other country. And what is it going to do to get those resources? When we're talking about exchanges like this, a lot of what we're looking at is actually looking at our own defense mechanisms, how we are making our own countries more resilient to any attack or any threat that's coming through, and whether that is Russia or China, or even threats within. I think all countries really have to just think about the fact that media literacy, political literacy, those are not necessarily skills that are widespread amongst the population, and that people aren't necessarily really equipped to differentiate very easily between what might be a false or planted narrative. So I think when we're doing exchanges like these, a lot of what we're really focusing on is less about, yes, there are external threats, but we can't control what other countries are doing, but we can work together so that we're actually better equipped to address those threats, whatever direction they might be coming from.
Thank you, Sydney. Paul, in 2019, China launched the Made in China 2025 state-led industrial policy that puts China on a path to catch up with and then surpass Western technological prowess. I want to get your thoughts on, A, how close you think they are to achieving this goal, but secondly, do you think there is awareness about its implications in Western civil society and UK media discourse? You know, do you sense that most people are aware of what's going on here?
I think probably not as aware as they should be. You know, there's no doubt that over a longer period, China has been focused on catch up in terms of technology. I think it depends which sectors you look at. You know, ones which I've perhaps got a bit more experience, I would say from a civil aerospace point of view, they're trying hard, but they're still a good way behind European and US industries. Certainly from a defense perspective, you know, I don't think they're quite where the West currently is. But in other areas, they clearly are catching up and catching up very quickly. So in a sector I used to be familiar with, in the auto sector, a decade or more ago, China was making a very big pitch to the electrification of its auto sector and has made very significant progress. It has also focused very hard on not just the technology, but how you secure that technology for the longer term. So, you know, one of the big challenges that we now see in Europe in the automotive sector is the desire for batteries, and more importantly, the desire for the lithium and some of the rare earths that are essential for battery development and production. China is a very well placed in terms of those kinds of commodities because it's spent a long period of time creating the relationships internationally and securing those kind of raw materials. So I think there's no doubt that China is it sees technology as being its route to dominance, whether that is industrially or politically. And I think that inevitably fashions and people's attention chops and changes over time. As Sydney said, I think much of this is about communication, is around how we make our own societies aware of some of the challenges that are ahead. But I also think we need, perhaps internationally, to build stronger cooperation, because otherwise there is a danger from an industrial perspective that we're all trying to secure our own domestic well-being. But in doing that, we're actually competing more likely against nations that share very many similar outlooks to ourselves.
Obviously, we're living at an extraordinary time here in the UK with a confluence of so many different crises. But in the midst of all of this, other than having greater awareness of the international threats posed by these states, what else do you think we can do to communicate better in our society about what these threats mean and what these states are doing?
Yeah, I think education really is the starting point. In the past, you would have students learning civics, right? And I think right now, a lot of countries, what we need to be looking for is, what does a digital civics education look like? What does a civics education look like that prepares people to be global and national citizens in a 21st century context, where they are going to be seeing a lot more stimulation? There's a lot more information that comes at you. There's the greater need to be able to parse that information for bias, for what's accurate, to understand how sourcing works, to understand the content and the context through which something is coming. And in some ways, young people have an advantage because so many of them are digital natives and are maybe able to parse like what a fake website looks like maybe more quickly than some of older generations. And you also have a captive audience in terms of students, right? But when we look at where misinformation spreads, very often when you looked at COVID, for example, there was so much poor information, some deliberate and some just on account of ignorance, and how that was spreading through people, right? And if you have people who are already out of the school system, how do you help them also get to be in a position where they can parse that information correctly? So I think, as you mentioned, the first part is awareness, but then how do you actually turn that awareness into something where people are actively able to combat this? And I think one of those ways is really re-emphasizing our respect for media as the fourth estate, and also making sure that people have an understanding of what journalism is. You know, we have an unprecedented access to citizen journalism now, and what the wide range of what that means. Everyone has a camera in their hand. Everyone has the ability to speak to a wider platform than we have in the past. But that doesn't mean that they have journalistic training, right? That doesn't mean that they understand what it means to protect a source and to verify those sources. And so I think a lot more awareness on this part is still really needed. I don't know that we've moved beyond that awareness in terms of at least that media, that sort of resilience that we're trying to build. And to Paul's point, a lot of this really is cooperating so that we're not at cross ends, that if there is a country or even more local than that, that's found really a good best practice, that we're able to share that and disseminate it in a country context that makes sense for others as well, because we are all dealing with these same issues.
It's quite interesting when you look at the sort of concerns that we have about sort of scams of one form or another that go on online. And I think we are probably much more proactive and still probably need to be more proactive in equipping people to understand how they differentiate between a genuine offer that they might be receiving online or through one of a social media channel and clearly something that is designed to effectively rob them or a threat to them. And I think it would be perhaps interesting to consider how we build people's trust through helping them understand that scamming aspect of online or social media exposure as a way of actually then allowing us to ask or to inform them about some of the other things that happen online that they may also wish to think more carefully around. Again, I'm just conscious that certainly I've done in my previous role, and I'm aware that things like the National Cyber Security Centre in the UK is doing a lot to ensure that people are secure online. But we don't necessarily roll that into some of the other online harms that are actually out there.
No, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. And I think people are probably generally quite unaware about how much that online activity is state-driven. So that's a very important point. I want to get your thoughts on space capabilities. We know that Russia and China are really putting considerable investment into their capabilities in space. And I wanted to get both of your thoughts on what can the UK and the US do to maintain their edge, starting with you, Paul, and then
So there's no doubt we are now in a new kind of space race to the ones that perhaps were, you know, the 60s and 70s. We are seeing the national government's response to this. So the UK now has a national space policy. And much like the US, we now have an arm of our armed services who are dedicated to space. And they're looking, I guess, at a number of different things. Firstly, I suppose the basic is that, you know, a lot of space infrastructure is up there and much of our modern world depends upon it in one form or another. So there is a certain pillar of activity, certainly in the UK, which is around, you know, how do we create greater resilience of that space infrastructure? How do we ensure that were it to be targeted in any kind of conflict type situation, how do we ensure that we've got alternatives that allow us to have resilient systems? How do we build that resilience? How do we protect that infrastructure from external threat? And again, how do we ensure that we are ahead of the game in terms of what others are doing? Space is now a very, very crowded place. And, you know, the combination of both low Earth orbit satellites and higher orbit satellites and the debris that is out there means that there's not just a challenge in terms of national security, but also a way in which we manage that domain in a more organized manner.
Sydney, your high-level thoughts on that?
Well, this is definitely not my area of expertise, but I will say, I think when you're looking at Western countries and the US included, a lot of the issue I see here is funding and split focus, right? And how do you convince people that this is worth putting a significant amount of resources into when you're also facing threats from a lot of different areas? You know, I think in many countries here in the US, there is a cost of living crisis looming. And when people can't heat their houses, how interested are they in hearing about funding going to NASA or other space agencies? And I think, as Paul said, there's a lot of our infrastructure that actually does depend on satellites and does depend on keeping that infrastructure current and competitive. But I'm not sure that that is always at the forefront of people's minds. I think in many ways, and this goes back to other things we're talking about, is that we don't necessarily have a great science communication. A lot of people study science into, at least in the US, most they'll take a freshman year course in their undergraduate. And I think you saw the lack of that science awareness and how to talk about it under COVID as well, right? When you're talking about public health, the number of people who really didn't have even the basic understanding of epidemiology to really know what we're talking about here. And so I think with space, as other things, there's so many other things that are on the forefront of people's minds. I think the climate challenge is there as well. And so I think there is a need to express really clearly what are the benefits that people are going to see from greater investment in space infrastructure and what they can expect to see in their day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, you really are running up against more of a domestic political will issue.
I was just thinking again in you know, perhaps the sad experiences in Ukraine and, you know, more recent footage around drones and drone activity. I think it is possible to explain to people the way in which modern warfare is changing and that national security threats are changing. And as a consequence, there are simply things that we need to do to provide them with the basic security that most people have become used to. And with the proliferation of particularly private sector satellites, there is a bigger challenge for nation states to differentiate and make secure the infrastructure that is most important to them. You know, again, I think there's a job to communicate the difference between what the likes of Elon Musk are doing and in the UK, Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, all interesting things. And I'm sure all with their own set of values, but they aren't things that are going to deliver safety and security for people from the sorts of state actors that we see playing out in front of us.
When you're looking at Richard Branson in space or Elon Musk or others, I think that it runs the risk then of people feeling like space and going to space is the purview of the rich and maybe a frivolous thing that doesn't have that much to do with their day-to-day life, you know, and that tends to be flashier. It's much more exciting or interesting to watch somebody up in a rocket than it is to maybe talk about some of those infrastructure issues. And so that kind of comes back again to how do you make this salient to people and how do you cut through the information that we're getting all the time so that people are actually thinking about this in a different way?
There's so many blurred lines here, though. Where do you draw the line between state-sponsored Starlink enterprises and private enterprises? It's interesting to unpack that, but how do we simplify that and make it easier for people to understand so that they can feel more secure and be more resilient towards misinformation and other sorts of attacks? I don't think we're going to figure this all out today. but it has been absolutely fascinating talking to you guys about it. And I hope that there will be many more conversations like this in the future, especially around communicating in an increasingly uncertain age, how to protect our societies better. Thank you both for joining.